Boom, we're on. Today's guest, we've got undefeated fighter Joe Calzaghe. Joe, absolute honour, honestly.
Nice to meet you, man.
Sitting across from an absolute legend, one of the greatest boxers of all time.
Thank you, bro.
Undisputed, super middleweight. You held all the belts. Unbelievable achievement. It's honestly buzzing to be sitting across from you.
Massive fan
for years. How've you been, brother?
Yeah, it's been all right. It's been good. Yeah. You know, it's a long time ago, isn't it? It's mad how quick time goes when you're retired, to be honest, you know. But what can I say, you know, to achieve what I've achieved, you know, with my father, you know, remember my dad Enzo, you know, it's amazing.
What a career. 46, you know, like I say, one of the greatest of all time. You're up there with your Floyd Mayweathers, your Rocky Marcianos. I don't think people realise how big, true boxers do. What you went through and what you achieved, it's nothing short of, I don't even have a word for it, but it's unbelievable. Two-weight world champion, kid from Wales, just came through the ranks, some massive fights, Chris Eubank, you've got Hopkins, Jones, the man there in the back.
Kessler, Jeff Lacey, those are big fights. Big fights, but, you know, I didn't get them big fights, you know, to sort of to the end of my career, you know what I mean? So, it was a long, long time, a lot of injury problems. You know, I started boxing as a 9-year-old, you know. I still remember the first time my dad took us to the gym. Not this is a plus gym. I mean, about 2 miles away, it was like a shed, it was made of tin. And basically, that was where I started. But a trainer called Paul Williams at the time, he was called Newbie Jam at the Boxing Club. New with JBC, so you know, he took me to the gym, and I would say that I loved it straight away, but I actually was I loved playing football as well. My dad being from Sardinia, it basically obviously, you know, I went to football under 10s, went to the boxing gym. I used to skip the boxing gym while my dad was doing music, he's a musician, and go to the football. But my first fight as a 10-year-old, a lot of people don't know this, I actually lost my first fight. Lost my first ever fight. His name was Chris Stock.
You remember him as well?
Chris Stock. I'll tell you my story, right? So my first ever fight, 10-year-old, in a workman's club, smoky workman's club. And all I remember was when they said he won on the majority decision, split decision. I just remember having my hands like this and crying. And the trainer was Paul Williams at the time, the first coach, to take me out of there. And I remember how horrible that felt. Losing, do you know what I mean? So I lost my first ever fight. I must have beat him 6 times afterwards.
Throw that in there, Joe.
And not just that, but his father was one of the judges. That's not fair, right? But so it's mad that just going to show you, I wasn't a natural from the start. You know, it was hard work, and that's what happened. You know, started winning a few, losing a few, but it all came together when I was 12. So I was started rededicating myself, realized I was never going to be Roberto Baggio of the world, okay? So I started really focusing. Things were starting to click. I mean, my dad was training me every day of the week. You know, he used to kick my ass every day of the week. No messing around. I come home from school and it rain, sleet or snow, he'd make sure I go for a run. Even if I didn't want to go for a run.
At 12?
Yeah, he had a struggle for weight then. It was 36 kilograms. So I had a little bit of a growth spurt. So I won the world's title. Boxed in the ABAs, and like I said, won the fastest win of the tournament, boxer boy called Ian Raby from London. So remember, won in the first round. Forgot my boxing boots, so I was really pushed to wear trainers in that fight. So it was, that was it. As soon as I won that first ABA title, 1985, and that was it. The feeling of being a winner, it was like, wow. You know, this is what I want to do for a living and to be a world champion one day. It was my dream, and thank God I had my father, you know, who believed in me, truly believed in me, and gave me that mindset that you are going to be a world champion one day. Even through injuries, I got told I wasn't going to box again when I was 17, 18, you know, with a wrist injury and so on. And kept pushing and kept having the faith I'd do it.
So your dad's background was from Italy, your mum was from Wales. And your dad, what was that story? How did they two connect?
Yeah, so my grandfather, after the war, like a lot of Italian immigrants, moved to Bedford. So my dad, sort of at the age of, I think about four, five, him and his brothers and sister, they basically moved to Bedford. And my granddad worked really hard in the stonemasons, I think, and he was also a chef. And so my dad was brought up like as English, if you know. So his English was his first language, right? So he came up as a kid. And I think when he was around 14, 15, my grandfather, they owned their own house, which was the first in the Italian community. They used to work non-stop, my granddad, you know, Nonno Giuseppe, who I'm named after. Right, amazing guy. Amazing. Yeah, I miss him. And yeah, they moved back. But my father was went back to Sardinia. He went to national service. So in national service, he was a really good footballer, my dad, right? So played in national service. He played with a guy called Nicolai, who played for Juventus. Good footballer, very quick winger, and he wanted to be a footballer. But there's a lot of music in the family on my grandfather's wife. So my nan's side, Porodu side, he's a musician. He's still alive, Mazio Vincenzo, right? Manco Vincenzo, and my name, dad was named after. So my grandfather just basically said, you can't play football. You're going to have to play music. So he taught him how to play the bass. And that was the end. So as soon as he done his first gig, discovered women and alcohol, and football was fucked off, right? So my dad wanted to be a musician. He grew his hair long and everything. You know, loved the Beatles, you know, loved music. But in Sardinia, he just didn't fit in. And he missed going back. He missed England. You know, he loved the Beatles. He missed England. So the story is like, so basically, my dad wanted to move. What he did, he basically went, the story is he got my dad, my granddad was in work. He crawled up in Sassari where he's from. So he got up a lamppost, crawled for the window, got his passport and a few quid he had. He got his guitar on his back and he just left. He left, he hitchhiked his way around Europe. He spent time in Amsterdam, slept in the bridges, just busking his way around Europe, wanting to get back to England. And the story is that he come to Bedford to meet my auntie Janina. Thankfully for me, she just went back to Sardinia. So he's going to hitchhike back to Italy because he had nowhere to stay. And as it happened, he bought a big bottle of VAT 2020. Right, got pissed, right? Got the wrong side of the road, and as he went back to Le Havre, so he went from over to Le Havre, wrong side of the road, and then ended up back in England. So he woke up next to him like, what the fuck, I'm back in England. So he went back to Bournemouth, which one of his friends, and cut long story short, he said he's going to Wales. So he had a mate that knew somebody in Wales, and I'm not sure some girl in Wales or whatever. So cut long story short, he went to Wales. My dad was in Cardiff and he had no money, even for a cup of coffee, right? So he went into the Wimpy where my mum was 17 and was working in the Wimpy. So the stories my mum used to say, like, he went in and he asked for a cup of tea and she went to get a cup. No, I mean coffee, tea. And my mum wouldn't serve him. So she said, this guy's taking the piss. Can you serve him? Because my mum's shy. That was usually 16. So my dad would have been about 19. And that was that. And basically he waited for my mum and he was pissing out in the rain outside. He waited for my mum to come out. And my mum, because she worked at Wimpy, was like free burgers. And my dad was starving and he was like, oh, can I get out of one of your burgers? And my mum gave him one of her burgers. And what can he say? You know, they sort of, I think went somewhere to like for a drink or to some disco. That was some free disco or whatever. And yeah, they sort of connected, thanks to me, you know, thank God. And what happened then is they got together. Then they decided to go to London, where my mum worked at 20th Century Fox. My dad still trying to do music and so on, and worked there as well. And I was born in Hammersmith, and so I was born in Hammersmith, London. And then from Hammersmith, they went to Sardinia, hitchhiked to Sardinia. We have to edit that one because that's before the story mixed up a bit. So they went to Sardinia. Yeah, did they hitchhike to Sardinia? On the train. Sorry, so they hitched on the train to Sardinia. I would live there for about 12 months. And then my mum missed home because she's from South Wales, not far from South Wales, a place called Treniga. And yeah, they come back. And that's it. You know, I was sort of settled with my grandmother or my mum's mum in a place called Markham. It's not far from here. And then, yeah, we sort of had a house there, a council house. It was a council estate called Penramaugh. And that's where they settled.
And that's where they raised one of the greatest.
A story. So, yeah.
It's about a gypsy lifestyle, that, isn't it?
Yeah,
busking,
yeah.
Homeless.
But you know what? I used to, like, my dad, you know, like I say, he was a musician at the bank with Fawn Legion with my Uncle Lucho, my Uncle Sergio. And they actually had the record contract. They sort of gigged with Paul Young. Baron Knight's a band that managed my dad. So I used to hitchhike. I used to love it. I used to fucking love it, man. In the 80s, I was 14 and I used to hitchhike from, because they were based in Milton Keynes, right? So the story is, my mum didn't want to go to Milton Keynes and they were on the verge of like splitting up at the time. And thankfully for me, because I was going to leave where I am here to go to Milton Keynes, and my mum stopped the keys and there was a place called Lakes Estate, which, you know, there's no boxing gyms there. Put it that way. I don't know what would have happened to me, but I wouldn't have been a boxer.
Ain't it mad how all the stars aligned for where you end up in life, like from your dad busking, traveling all through Europe, just searching, ends up in Wales, meeting a woman, fucking, basically running away to Sardinia, busking, homeless again, hitchhiking.
Yeah.
Like, ain't life mad? It's mad. It still puzzles me. Like, I'm a weird thinker. Like, I can look up at the stars and I just think, what the fuck is going on out there? Like, it's just life is mad. And to then all that, and then for your careers, again, it's unbelievable. But when you were going through schooling as well, Joe, you had a tough time with bullies and stuff.
Yeah.
Because I know you wanted to play football. And was that one of the reasons why you changed from football to boxing to then defend yourself against bullies?
No, not at all. And believe it or not, I was ABA champion, but I was only smaller, like 5'10". And the comprehensive school I went to was outside my catchment area. And it was really strange. It was like one day, at the year three, I was like 14, I went to school. And it was like everybody was ganging up on me. It was like people who thought my friends was my friends. And I thought sometimes name calling, it wasn't like physical, it was like name calling.
Mental abuse.
Yeah. You know, and that's really tough when you're young. And I always remember there's like about 30 kids come up to my house. I still remember it on bikes and I was going to fight this one boy. So my dad said, well, that's all right, you were 1-1. But they were going to jump me, right? So my dad goes out, he said, I'll tell you what, you and you go on down the lane and fight. Do you know what I mean? Not all of you together. Obviously, it didn't happen. He didn't want to know. But when I went back to school, I just got called names, just got isolated. And then I'd sort of become, it's really weird, man. Just like...
Recluse?
Yeah. I just sort of isolated myself from people, and it really affected me. And it's, boxing was my escapism. It's like, I was a completely different person. Like when I was outside school, I don't know why I didn't change school. I should have changed school, but maybe that's part of me being stubborn. And it probably did affect my schoolwork, although all I wanted to do was box. And my dream was just become a world champion. You know, I was doing okay in school. I wouldn't say I was academic. I wasn't really that bothered with school. Certain subjects I was okay with, but I just wasn't bothered. It's like, I remember speaking with a careers teacher and I remember her saying to me, I remember she was about 50, so what are you going to do when you leave school? And I was like, I'm going to be a world champion. She just looked at me and laughed. I said, not seriously, Joe, like, Joseph, I think she called me. What are you going to do when you leave school? I'm going to be a world champion. But that's what I truly, truly believed in my mind, because at the time I was winning 2-3 ABA titles. In school, I was getting taken the piss out of all the time, made to feel like shit coming home, not wanting to go to school. And it's weird to say that the safest place for me was the ring, and I loved it. And that was where I felt worthy. I felt some self-worth and felt somebody was when I was boxing.
Is that because people were taking away your confidence, taking away your self-belief, but yet you were feeling more at ease while you were actually fighting?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I felt like. Felt like somebody, you know? That's what I felt like, home. A boxing ring is my home, and they're going up there, beating people in the ring and, you know, learning and getting it all out, you know, because I was quite shy, very shy, you know, a very introvert. And boxing, I'd come out and I'd drop my hands, but outside I would be very quiet and within myself. And a lot of that is to do with, I think, for what happened in school. And you know what, it's best I won't change it, because that strengthened me up as a kid. So when I was boxing the likes of Lacey, boxing like Hopkins, were bullies, me learning that as a kid, I think,
Inner strength.
Yeah, give me the strength, and like, fucking, I've been there before.
Mm-hmm. Your last fight you lost, was it when you were 17? Was it amateurs?
Yeah, so the last fight I lost was in the European Junior Championships in Prague, in the old Czechoslovakia, 1990, July. I won my first fight against Hungary in one second round, and it's the first year you ever had to wear head guards, right? And I never wore a head guard. Even in pros, I never wore head guards. They'd have to wear a head guard, but I just hate head guards. And you put a big head guard on. And I boxed this Romanian guy, and he had this style, like, with his, and I'd never seen this style before, right? So I won my first fight and went into that fight, and he just kept flicking me, kept under my head guard. And anyway, I lost that fight. And I still remember, like, I lost two fights that year. I lost in the Welsh seniors against a fight called Michael Smythe and Barry on a split decision. Lost that fight on points. And at that time, I had a trainer called Paul Williams who trained me. He was the amateur boxing trainer, Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays. My dad would train me all the time, like I said. So what happened, I remember Paul Williams, he said, my dad was doing the music still in the band. And Milton Keynes coming back and forth. And I remember he was saying to me, I want you to turn pro. It's really hard. He's like a bit like a father figure, you know, because he was always trying to look after me in the gym and that. You know, obviously, when I say father figure, he's quite close to me, you know, boxing wise. And he wanted me to sign a piece of paper to turn pro. As a kid, I was 17. I was like, I don't want to like turn pro. And I had to tell him, it was hard to say, oh, you know, I was really young. I never saw him again since. You know, he basically gave the keys to my father and said to my dad, yeah, you all at the gym. So my dad said to me, Joe, do you want me to train you? And as a main trainer, although he was my trainer anyway, right? As a main trainer, I thought, yeah, let's just do it. So think about it. Like, we went on to win three consecutive ABA titles. It should, you know, the one thing that pissed me off was not going to the Olympics in 92. And to be honest, that's the only time I see my dad cry when it comes to boxing. He had to come home and tell me, even though I was a, the reigning ABA champion nationals, I weren't selected to the Olympics because I was from an unfashionable gym in Newbridge, and all the people selected from Cardiff, they selected the Cardiff boy to go to the qualifying tournament, who lost to Robin Reed, and Robin Reed went on to the Olympics and got a bronze medal. And I'm sat at home thinking I should be at the Olympics, you know, in 92. But it wasn't to happen. But anyway, won three consecutive ABAs. After the second, I was going to turn pro. I went welterweight, light middleweight. And dad said, listen, nobody's won three ABAs at three different weights. Just, you're only 19, 20. Just win another one. So I did. So I won another ABA. And then, we basically had a conversation with Mickey Duff, an old promoter called Mickey Duff and Terry Lawless, right?
That sounds a corrupt name anyway.
Yeah, so we drove up to Wardour Street. I still remember it. And I agreed, being a three times ABA champion, I didn't speak to any of the promoter. I didn't speak to Barry Earn at the time or Frank Warren at the time. And it's because we were naive, you know, we just wanted to turn pro. So anybody thinking hindsight, like, you know, what was I fucking doing? Like, so basically, I walked out there with a £3,000 loan. I thought it was the sign-on fee. And I was on £300 a week. And I was on £300 a week for 21 fights. I'd become British champion, young boxer of the year. And so I was on £300 a week. Then I didn't realize that £300 a week was a loan. So I basically, I had a baby. So my ex-wife got pregnant. I was still renting a place, like semi-detached. I literally had like £200 in the bank. So like 19 KOs. British champion, had a fight on ITV. I didn't even know the purse. And my dad knew. I said, Dad, you know, and at the time I was frustrated because Frank Warren was taking over and I wasn't getting no airtime. None of my fights were getting shown on TV. And my father, my dad went up to London to speak to Frank Warren. And so basically, you know, he offered me decent money, good sign-on fee. And because I got fucked over regarding never seen in contracts and that, it just... I had to pay him the loan.
So you're paying to fight, basically?
I had to pay a loan. The first thing I did was that £3,000. I bought a Ford Sierra.
Old cars.
I didn't have no insurance, no license. I was driving around for like 3 years and suddenly I'd done a quick test and I passed my test, thank God. First time.
So you'd signed a deal for 21 fights. Your first 21 fights, you had 20 knockouts, British title, flying, starting to make a kind of name for yourself in the
scene.
Yeah,
I was Young Boxer of the Year.
And you were getting shafted.
Yeah, I never saw a contract. And, you know, it was just...
How did you even know you were still in a contract?
Well, that's it. You know, that's how I got out of it because I remember Frank Warren is obviously signature on the contract. And obviously, you know, they were my managers and also my promoters. So it's a conflict of interest. I mean, so obviously looking after themselves. So I was fighting, I was getting frustrated, and I thought something's got to happen. And as it happened, yeah, same with Frank Warren. I had three fights and he promised a world title fight and it happened. You know, I had the three fights. I was on Sky Sports, which was great. I was where I wanted to be. I was getting paid decent money. And then, yeah, I was just, you know, it was great. I had a fight with Steve Collins. Steve Collins was the champion and he sort of, he didn't fancy the fight. You know, he said he was injured. There's a couple of reasons, but yeah, I understand why he didn't. You know, obviously he was in big fights with Eubank and Ben, and obviously he's fighting this young kid that's not really got a massive name. 20 knockouts in 21 fights. Is it worth the gamble? But then stepped Chris Eubank, who, if anything, I was more wary of with the Eubank because he's one of them guys that when his back's against the wall, he's a dangerous fucking animal.
But you put him on his ass the first, 20 seconds, the first minute or something?
Nah, that's the thing. It's probably the worst thing I did, right? Because bear in mind, I knocked my first 20 fights before my hands started packing in because my hands got worse as my career went on. I knocked 19, I think, out of the first 20 fights. And I went 8 rounds twice, 5 rounds once. Everybody else was knocked out first 2 rounds. So he boxed in the guy, Eubank, who's been in wars, who's seasoned, man. He knows to get in there. I always remember, like, the press conference, I was cocky as fuck. So I remember, I think it was at the Grove, and I was like, fucking Chris Eubank. You know what I mean? I'm a fucking boyfriend looking on the train from the valleys. You know what I mean? I finally got the spotlight. And I see his Harley Davidson outside. I love watching Eubank, Ben, and Collins, and all these. So I remember saying, I just remember looking across to him, and he's like, I said, I'm going to knock you out. He just looked at me and went, I'm going to take you to one place that you've never been. I'm going to take you to the wow. And I'm looking, it was fucking wow, right? But trust me, in that fight, after 3 or 4 rounds, I was fucked. That's the only way to explain it. I was exhausted. I think that I didn't know how to sort of pace myself. The excitement got to me. And dropping him with my first left hook, like Eubank's down, I'm like trying to finish him, throwing everything at him. Nothing more disheartening after about 5-6 rounds when you know you're only halfway through the fight. Inside, you know you're not going to knock him out. And you see him walking around doing this, like walking around the ring, and I'm like out of breath, I'm panting, but you know, just exhausted, absolutely exhausted. And he was true to his promise. You know, he did take me to the well. And it was by far the toughest fight I ever had as regards to exhaustion. I was fucking completely exhausted, man. Like, I couldn't move for 3 days afterwards. Like, lactic acid, could not move. It was really, really tough. And like you said,
Because he'd only lost 2 fights prior to that, too, Steve Collins.
Yeah, I know. But he was, I think, because Eubank used to fight, he had a good rest. And he was tough.
He as tough as people say? Like, I've always rated him. People love to hate him, but people love to, because he's that guy. When you see him, you do want to watch him because it's his character, it's his things that he does, what he says. But what a fighter! So when you put him on his ass and he told you, look, you're coming to the trenches with me,
like, and then
every time, every interview I've watched with Eubank, he's always spoke highly of you because people says you couldn't punch, but he says you're fast and you're it's painful. Steve Collins, every time I watched him, because I watched you all sitting around the table, he never ever seemed to give you credit. Why do you think that is? Do you think he was fearful of you?
Collins, I just think, well, I honestly believe Collins would have been an easier fight than Eubank. Well, saying easier, because Eubank was fucking tough, man. Do you know what I mean? But I mean, I was preparing for Steve Collins, different style than Chris Eubank. Like Steve comes to you. I love counterpunching. It was Lacey fights. I love people coming to me. I was preparing for Steve Collins. So when he sort of retired 10 days before the fight, Eubank was already boxing on the card. He was already fit. But I was more worried about Eubank because, you know, you see what happened with himself and Mike Watson. He got injured. So you're a young kid and you see how dangerous he can be. You've seen him against Nigel Benn. He goes down, he gets back. And he's tough. And he was hungry. He wanted, and I'm like, Okay, I was more nervous. I'll be honest with you, I was more a bit more nervous fighting Eubank than I was fighting Steve Collins. And yeah, like I said, man, I remember I was supposed to come in the ring at 10, got pushed back to 11 o'clock. I didn't get in the ring till fucking 12 o'clock, right? So I got so excited in the change rooms. Me and Dad did about fucking 15 rounds on the pads, right? So I remember getting in the ring, I was all like, the music, was it Sheffield Arena? Oh man, I was just fucking, like I said, I was just, after the first couple of rounds, I was tired. I was knackered, I was exhausted. Did, like I said, didn't pace myself, nervous energy and so on. And imagine everything you've ever trained for all your life on that one night, from going, not just financially, but your dream as a 10-year-old to become world champion against somebody that I've admired and watched as an amateur, watching him against Ben Watson, you bad. Oh, one day you'll have to fight him, and you're fighting him.
Yeah.
You know?
Because when you won the British title, you didn't look as happy, because I think you done an interview after and it says, well, it's nothing because I won the world title. Then when you eventually won the world title, what's that feeling like, Joe, for everything you've worked hard for? Everybody kind of underrated at that time, people just saying that you're doing shortcuts, this and that, but to then beat one of the best, one of the greatest. How was that feeling?
Yeah, it was an awesome feeling, but like it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough. I wanted to be a unified world champion. And that's the thing, I always set myself goals. And my dad always said something to me that stuck in my head, always train like a challenger. And it's when you train like a champion, that's where they lose. You know what I mean? So always train like a challenger. Like, so beating Eubank, I wanted to unify the title. And unfortunately, because of boxing as it is, business of boxing, when your stock has risen and you are a world champion, the other champions don't want to fight. And unfortunately, I want to fight Robin Reed when he was WBC champion. But when he just lost, then I fight him. So again, he just lost a title, and then I fight him. The same with Richie Woodall, who's WBC champion. He just lost, so I fight him. Then there's Charles Brewer, there's the guy called Byron Mitchell. So all these guys have just lost titles. And then I fight him, so I beat six basically world champions without their belt. So that was really frustrating, and I was a bit disheartened about it, because, you know, we tried to make the fights early with Roy Jones and Bernard Hopkins way before it happened, and it just wasn't happening. And Sven Ocker was another one, a German fighter that he wouldn't fight. And I started getting injured. I was injured a lot. Some of my fights, to be honest, I found it a struggle to get motivated for. You know, I remember boxing on the undercard of Mike Tyson and against the fighter called David Starry. I remember people booing. It's fucking disheartening, man. It's like, for fuck. But it was just styles didn't mix, and I was switching off in fights. It's like, you should never switch off. I remember sat in the corner looking around. My dad, give me a fucking, what are you looking around for? I was like, I'm struggling to get motivated. It's like I've reached that level and I want to fight the next level. I was struggling a little bit for motivation. I was always 100% fit, but I mean up here, you know, I didn't fear an opponent. I know I could beat that guy. That's why I always fought the best. The best fighter I boxed is when you saw the best of me. Like Lacey, Kessler, then you see me fight my best. But other fighters, I'm supposed to be quite easy. I would like maybe switch off a bit. Although I'd always be fucking tremendously fit. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I always had a great engine because I trained hard, but up here, man, you need that little bit of a fear factor to think, if I don't fight my best, you know, I could lose.
Do you think that's where bullying at school kicks into play? I don't want to be bullied, so, because I know in the Lacey fight, is it Lacey?
Yeah.
You were scared. You were going to pull out 2 weeks before. I think you got injured as well. Why was that? Was that the fear of everything? Do you think that stems from school days as well?
I'm not sure. With Lacey, I just fear of failure, and it's something I always had. I lost 9 amateur fights in 120 fights. Last defeat was a 17. So all of a sudden, I got this fight. Jeff Lacey comes along, right? You know, he's by 90% of the press, he was going to beat me. You know, boxing news, like 90%. I was a bookies underdog the only time ever. And yeah, I wanted to fight, you know. I think 2 weeks before the fight, I got injured. I'll be honest, it wasn't a massive injury, but it was an injury. It played on my mind. I went to Harley Street. I still remember going to Harley Street, having an injection in my hand. I come back. I was on the Great Western, the train, Ratler coming back. I still remember it. I was, hey, Dad, what? He said, I got to pull out. You're a fucking liar. What do you mean pull out? And I always remember him saying, Joe, if you pull out, they're going to call you a fucking chicken. What do you mean a chicken? So you already pulled out the fight. You can't pull out. You're going to fight this fight. Anyway, cut off. And I remember coming to this gym in that ring. And I said, Dad, you know, he said, Joe, you're in fucking shape, amazing shape. And this is Dad who never boxed, right? But he knew my style more than anybody. He said, fucking forget what people say about this guy. He said, listen, you're the shape of your life. He said, you're going to beat this guy with one hand. I said, what are you on about? You can beat this guy with one hand. I said, Dad, fucking, I'm telling you now. He's like, just said exactly what was going to happen. After this fight, you're going to go to America. You're going to be a fucking superstar. You're going to be where you want after this fight. He said, forget these fucking so-called experts. Listen. And he said something so simple. He's like, listen, this guy moves 4 or 5 times before he's one punch. You throw 5 punches and move once. I move around, so work it out. He said, from the first round to the 12th, no matter what, you're gonna annihilate him. This guy's gonna make it look great. And I'm thinking, obviously, I listened to my dad. I'm still injured, I didn't spar for 2 weeks. And he just said, you know, which is probably the thing that meant more to me, just turned around and said, you know what, Sainz, listen, I'm proud of you no matter what. But you have to fight this fight. When I lose, you have to fight this fight. And I was done as soon as he said that. But even though I couldn't punch for 2 weeks and beforehand I was thinking about pulling out, I was still doing my runs. I was still getting up at 2 a.m, doing 5 mile runs in the dark. So I was still in that, I don't know, you know, I'm thinking, am I going to fight this fight? Am I, you know, can I postpone it a few weeks? But realistically, it was never going to be postponed. And what can I say? When I look at fights, the Lacey fight, you know, just being the underdog, you know, being written off by your own press, even fucking, I remember my father had an argument with somebody in the bookies because somebody in the bookies come in and said, come have a bet on Jeff Lacey knockout Zygers, my fucking local town, you prick. And then he kicked off. My dad's all you fucking bet on him. So that like a bet. And honestly, a lot of people thought I was going to lose that fight. But you know what? It's... I remember like it was something surreal in that fight. All the nerves I had, everything I had the day before the fight, we went up and the day before the fight, it was snowing. I love the snow. I remember getting up in the morning and it's like, everything was calm. And even traveling on the train, all my nerves had gone. I was laughing, joking, we were playing cards. You know, my Sergio, my uncle, my trainer, obviously dad. We went up and I was just like at the press conference, at the workout beforehand, I was just so relaxed that I just felt it was my time. I remember walking from the hotel to the arena. I was a bit tired, right? I was a bit knackered. I was watching some film and I hate cold showers, man, right? Even though I jumped in the cold shower, jumped fucking back. And I fucking ate for water, right? So we walked to the MEN from the hotel. But bang, as soon as the lights come on, I was like, shh. I was just fucking just zoned in and just when I think about that fight, it's like, even when I got caught early on, I didn't feel nothing. It just, I think I could, I was on such a high that night. I feel I could have done it for 15 rounds. You know, I threw over 1,000 punches or whatever. And it just, that was probably the most tuned in I've ever been for a fight. It was just unbelievable. I was so proud, obviously, you know, my dad said, I told you, I fucking told you so. I told you what you're going to do. And what happened afterwards, you know, my career went to another level. Mm-hmm. Obviously, America took notice, you know, HBO, Showtime, you know, the big names. And that's where, at the age of 33, after boxed all them years, 33, 34, finally, I'm on to another stage where
you can showcase your talent.
Yeah.
With the Lacey fight, why do you think that you were so fearful of him, though? Because, what, was he 20-0? They were saying that he was potentially the next Mike Tyson at the super middleweight division.
Yeah, I wasn't fearful of him. I was never feared of any guy.
He was solid, though.
But I wasn't fearing him. But like, it's just, the only thing, what drove me more than anything was a fear of failure, of losing, of failure. I still remember that first fight I ever lost as a 10-year-old. I remember the last fight I ever lost...
17.
When I was 17. I remember the Welsh Championship. I remember I've only lost like 9-10 fights. 120. I tell you about my losses, but I can't tell you about most of my wins. So I fear of So a fear of failure, and it's because I trained all this time to get to this unification fight. So from being world champion in 1997, 9 years of champion until I get a unification fight, then you're injured. Do you know what I mean? I'm injured. And I couldn't spar. So then you start having self-doubt in myself, like I could postpone it, you know what I mean? Maybe a few weeks, because obviously my hand, like I had to have the injection. So I basically had injections, painkiller injections in my hand for years before fights.
Why did your hands end up so bad, Joe?
Punching people in the head.
Just pretty simple question.
But hands were these like, yeah, I had hand trouble.
Did it cause you through so many punches though?
No, but what happened? I adapted my style because when I was younger, I used to be a big, big puncher, right? I remember sparring with Nicky Piper. I love Nicky, right? So Nicky come to the boxing gym in my old gym. I was only 18, ABA champion. And he just boxed Nigel Benn. Right? He just boxed Nigel Benn. And I remember him coming, he was going to box for a European professional title. So I walked to the gym with my bag, got into my old gym. And Nicky was there, like, and he looking sharp, man. I think he had a Mercedes, a lovely car outside. Fucking. To me, he's like big name. Like, he just boxed, give Nigel Benn a really good fight. You know what I mean? And he's boxed for a European title. And Charlie Pierce, the trainer, said, oh, can Joe do like 6 rounds? Joe, don't do 6 rounds? Like, yeah, no. The gym was full of kids and that, yo. Like, Gavin was young and the boys in the gym. And I remember sparring and he was like, boom, boom. Fucking, I'm just worried about, okay, back in. I remember slipping over and hitting him with a left and dropping him first round. So I go, Nicky Pipe, we just boxed for a world title, give Nigel Benn a fight. So that was really good for me, like. And he wobbled and he dropped. And I thought, brilliant. You know what I mean? I was only like 18, 19. And he was a lot bigger than me as well. He got back up. He'd done 3 rounds of his training. Went like, that's enough. And he said to Nick, he said, don't, you know, ends. Tell Joe not to see it. I won't say nothing. I fucking told everybody, man. I was working over the moon. And I was thinking, so in my mind, I was thinking, I just fucking, just outboxed and dropped Nicky Piper. Just beat, you know, just boxed Nigel Benn. And went like 10, 11 rounds, tough fight with him. Good fighter, bigger than me. Just all them things. So I was a big puncher and I start my first 6, 7, 8, 10 fights as a pro, knocking everybody out first round. So when the hands started to go, the injections, the cortisones, I mean, every fight I had to have a painkiller before I got in the ring, basically, because I couldn't punch. So then I adapted my style. I think, well, I can't be loading up with my left hand anymore. So me and Dad used to work on speed. Even sparring, when I sparred, I did spar, but I spar with small guys. So I just move around, let them, you know, for my reflexes. I sparred with the boys in the gym, like Nathan Cleverly, Bradley Price. It's small, but I wouldn't load up on them because I couldn't. It's no point me sparring with big guys. Like Enzo Matt, we'd tap about. So that was my sparring, was really moving, tapping around. Never had wars in the gym, you know? And to be honest, I think having wars in the gym isn't a good thing because you don't get paid to get beat up in sparring. You know, you get hit in the head enough. So, you know, for me, it was just doing my footwork, using my speed reflexes, feints. And if you look at it, that probably added to my longevity in boxing because I boxed to be at the peak of 36, 37 is very rare. You know, the Lacey fight came at 33. I fight Mikko Kessler, who's an absolute at this peak animal, 39-0. All the bouts, Cardiff in my national stadium, you know what I mean? And then to go to America at 36, 37, you know what I mean? It's like...
It's unbelievable.
You know, it's... It's mad.
So after the Lacey fight, then you got Kessler. He was 39-0. That was your biggest test for all the belts in the line, fighting at Millennium Stadium. What's going through your mind before that fight? Was that because you were still, people were always still, you were still underrated all the time. People were always doubting you. Why do you think there was so much doubt around you, even though the career that you had, that you were hitting 42-0, 43-0, why was there still doubt over your head?
I don't know. I think it was hard from the start because I was from South Wales Valleys.
Do you think you were an English boxer? You'd have been fucking everywhere.
Oh yeah, I think it was from a different country, different places. And I got a Sardinian father, Italian name, and from the Valleys, you know, near the Valleys. I mean, not in Cardiff. So me being from my little club stopped me going to the Olympics. And I think a lot of it was to get, it took a long time to get that sort of... Just the way it is, I think. But you know what? You know, like the Kessler fight, man, like I said, that was so much pressure on that fight because I remember watching Kessler in Copenhagen when I boxed on the Tyson undercard. Beat a fighter called Will McIntyre in five rounds. And I looked at the undercard, I thought, this fucking kid's going to be good, this boy. I just noticed straight away, Mikko, I think he's going to be a good fighter. I kept my eye on him, seeing him come through the ranks. And when we made that fight, it's a fight I wanted, you know. It's I wanted to be at that age of 34, 35. I just wanted to have all the belts. I was IBF champion, Ring Magazine champion, WBO champion, the two belts missing. And I was a WBA, WBC, which Mikael Kessler had. And yeah, I knew it was going to be a tough fight. I'd have to be at my best. And it was a lot of pressure, but I just don't think about the crowd, man. You know, you can't think, it's hard enough to just think about the guy you got to fight. And like what I say, you know, first four rounds was tough. He hurt me in the third round, buzzed me up a couple of, I think it was the third or the fourth, buzzed me a little bit, but I got a great chin. I leave it, fuck. Went back and one good thing, I just had to adapt. And that's one thing with my style, is quite unique. You know, I can change my style and just not really think about it. So I decided the box. So I started moving using my, started frustrating him, caught with a good body shot, in the eighth round, and just outboxed him. But, you know, using the fight from the first round to the 12th, he's probably the best fighter I've boxed. He was, like I said, 39-0. Myself, I was 42-0. All the belts, he was younger, you know, he was hungry. He was tough, you know, and I was just so happy to win that fight. But I knew that was going to be my last fight at super middleweight, because the struggle to make the weight was awful, man. I mean, like, I lost 36 pounds in 15 weeks for that fight. And the pain of not being able to eat, drink, the dehydration. And the 24, 36 hours before the fight wasn't enough to get my strength back. I was still weak. But I was, obviously, my energy, my fitness was there, but I was lacking my punching power, not just because of my hands, because draining my weight so much. And then that was it. And I said to Dad, like, I fucking done it. Like, 10 years, beat Mikko Kessler, basically got every belt there. So only one thing to do. And that was to go to America. And there's a big mouth out there called Bernard Hopkins. And I thought it'd be great to move up, be a two-way world champion. And I always wanted to fight in the States. I always wanted to fight in America. So that was the next step for me.
The journey, was there no anything coming into your mind to retire after you'd won all the belts, you'd achieved it all, or completion? Your main objective was to go to America and make a mark there, because Americans didn't rate you, did they? Because they think British, he's not fought anyone. Did you have to pay for your own flight to go to America to wind Hopkins up to build
yeah,
up for the fight?
Yeah, so that's where I'm there. I suppose I have more respect after the Lacey fight, you know. But I remember speaking with my old promoter, Time Warner, Frank Warren, and basically, I think what was happening at the time is I'm about fighting the O2, but I knew it was coming to the end of my career, fighting the O2, and I was like, I want to fight Hopkins. Other fights not going to happen, this and that. And I'm thinking, fucking, I want to fight Hopkins. You know what I mean? He's the one talking. I thought, let's just cut out the promoters and that side of it. I just beat Kessler 2 weeks before, and Ricky Hatton was boxing Mayweather. I could do with a fucking weekend away anyway. So it's me, Enzo, Mike, we went out there on the piss, celebrating. And so I remember going out there, I spoke to HBO, and this is like at the press room, and Hopkins was at the press room. And I still visualize that. I remember going in there, I could see him coming there, I fucking see him making his way with his entourage there. And that's when he says in beautiful words, I've never let a white boy beat me. And I'm going, if you fight me, you will lose. I didn't know what to say, if you fight me, you lose. And we just said back and forth. And then, bear in mind, there's no like social media really there. That was like on YouTube, but there was no like social media like you got now. But instantly, them words, and people say, oh, that means you offended. No, I was thinking, fucking brilliant. This fight's going to get made. It's going to be a big fight now because he said that. So that was it. I got on the phone to Frank. I said, you know, check out YouTube. I think me coming to Las Vegas and paying for my flights in my own room and this and that. And it was a good thing to do, because whether the fight would be made, I'm not sure. But if you think about it, you know, it's just an amazing experience. Come to Vegas from where I come from, the little halls I boxed, to be in, like in Vegas and seeing the likes of, you know, Sylvester Stallone, Arnold Schwarzenegger, you name them. Whitney Houston was like sat right behind my boy. And I remember what my boy told me after was when I got dropped first round, there's a woman put her hand on my boy, Connor, who's in my early, he's like, oh, your dad's going to be okay. Afterwards, like fucking Whitney Houston, that was like, do you know what I mean? It's mad, you know?
Michael J. Fox is a big fan of you. He was doing interviews and promoting you and talking highly of you. Was Al Pacino not there as well?
Al Pacino wasn't actually at the fight, but I was with him 2 days before because he had a premiere of one of his films, 88 Minutes.
What's he like?
Oh, he's fucking, that's one of the only times I've ever been starstruck. I was like, Al Pacino is like, Scarface looks quite small in real life, do you know what I mean? But honestly, he's one of my fucking favorite. I love Al Pacino. He's a lovely guy, do you know what I mean? He's a lovely guy, and it was nice to chat with him and for a little bit. And like I said, it was unbelievable. I stayed outside of the strip. And the strippers, I stayed outside. Not good before boxing. But I basically stayed, we hired the villa, to stay away from it, only really come into the strip to do the press conferences and so on. But yeah, like I said, man, it was a great night, great occasion. And to win that fight was brilliant. But then I knew that was it for me.
Tired. But you get put in your ass the first round by Hopkins.
I did.
Were you thinking, going up a weight, that I'm going to get beat? Or was there any time that you doubted yourself that maybe I stepped too much, step up too much?
No, not at all. I got dropped 4 times in my entire life. And never as an amateur, never as a, you know, never in the gym even, right? So there was a flash knockdown. I rushed him, I got caught. And out of the 4 times I went down, I wasn't hurt. But with Hopkins, he was very, very frustrating. His style was horrible. You know, styles blend, and we just didn't blend. He fought the perfect fight to beat me, which was just go defensive, grab on the inside, stop me from working. But, you know, after 4 or 5 rounds, my stamina, my engine, my punch work rate, I took over the second half of the fight. Of course, you're fighting in America. So, you know, I was nervous, obviously, afterwards. But I remember thinking, when they say split decision, you know, like, and then I was just, you know, so happy, you know, to win that. And that is the fight. I thought, I've done it. I want to finish. You know, I'm finished at the top. It's a fine line between going on too far in boxing, you know, and so on. And it wasn't about money, but legacy. It was about legacy for me. It was to have that perfect zero and be very rare meant more than keep fighting, losing, keep fighting and making a lot more money. It wasn't for me. And that's not what drove me. Obviously, we all would be comfortable, but I just felt I was cutting corners in the gym. I was, you know, I just injuries and so on. My kids were getting older. They were getting upset. I said, Dad, when are you going to retire? When are you going to retire? You know, and yeah, it was decision I made was, you know, to have one last fight.
Because your kids were upset that you get put down. Was that the first fight they'd ever really been at when they watched you, because they were upset at the end of that fight? I believe they wanted you to retire and they were still young at the time.
Yeah, they were still young. Yeah, Connor and Joe, they were about 10 at the time, and Connor's maybe 8. And I remember. Yeah, so my last fight, so that's the first time they saw me drop. So after Lacey Fire allowed them to come to watch me fight, so they come to Kessler. And I swear, I can't remember who boxed after it was Kessler. Or was it a couple more fights? And not Kessler, and obviously they come to America. But Connor was the youngest. I remember when I fought against Roy Jones Jr. at the Madison Square Garden, I'm warming up, ready to get in the ring. And when the security brings my boy, he's crying his eyes out because he remembers me getting dropped. And I'm thinking, oh, okay, so give him a hug before I get in the ring. But it's probably a good thing that when the change, I got fucking dropped again first round the night. I started making that habit of it.
See, when you beat Hopkins, was Freddie Roach Hopkins' trainer?
Yeah, Freddie Roach.
So how does Enzo, your father, a musician, but then being able to compete with one of the greatest trainers of all time to then, because did he not use music notes as for techniques for yourself? No, six and seven.
I don't know
where
they get that
from.
We just had our own style from young. It's hard to explain. We just evolved our style. You know, my dad, you know, we love Marvin Hagler, Sugar Ray Leonard. So he tried to blend them like both together. So like my dad is like, it wasn't just me, you know, he was obviously training Gavin Reese from his gym to be world champion. Oh, Enzo Mack come to this gym, become world champion. Nathan Cleverley, to be honest, you know, he was from this gym. He's trained us as a kid, so he was a world champion. So it's no coincidence. He had such a tremendous energy, my dad. He had such an energy. But not just that, he just knew me. He was the best trainer world for me. He knew every style would be awkward. He knew Hopkins would be awkward for me. He knew he would be awkward. He knew me inside out. He's watched me thousands of rounds sparring. I used to spar with my dad growing up. He could box a bit. You know, we used to spar together. And he knew it would be tough, that fight. But he was 100% confident, you know, that I would win. But he knew I'd have to work. He knew that Hopkins would spoil, go backwards, which I hate. I like people coming to me. I love to counterpunch, to chase a fight. So, after you know, you go back to your corner after the first round. You're in Las Vegas. You fucking just got dropped. You're thinking, shit, I'm two rounds down already. and it was frustrating. I kept trying to throw punches. And he kept holding on. It was just frustrating. Like, I had so much more energy. It wasn't a hard fight. It was a frustrating fight. It wasn't hard. It's like, I was fresh after 12 rounds. I didn't feel really tired, you know. But Hopkins, like, he's just an expert, you know. He's an all-time great, isn't he? You know, to be an all-time great. And I think, considering he was an old man when I boxed him, I think 6 years afterwards he won the world title at 50. So I think that win shows one of my best wins, if not the best wins, because you know he's an all time great. You know,
to get into America and beat an American in their own backyard, especially split decision. As soon as it says split decision, you must be thinking, "Fuck, I'm out. I've lost. I've got that loss to my name." But to win that is unbelievable again. So when you were getting through that, were you fighting that 12th round thinking, this is my last round?
All I was thinking was just work. I think after six rounds, I felt I was on top. Because although it was a messy fight, I felt I was outworking him. You know, he was just trying to buy time. He was feigning low blows and pretending he got it in the fucking balls. And I was like, come on, get him. Nerve-wracking, you know what I mean? It was nerve-wracking that. So when they say, I had a new... And it was like, yeah. So that was it, really. And I'll be honest, my last fight, I knew it was going to be my last fight. I spoke to Dad. We didn't say it to the press, but this is it now for me. I just felt this was it. You know, I was cutting corners, going into my last fight. Against Roy Jones Jr. And my dad sensed it, you know. I remember one day, I think I skipped training about 4 weeks. I was still in great shape, but I skipped about 2 days. And he said, hey, he said, know what? You're going to get your fucking ass kicked. I said, what are you about? He said, I know. What do you mean, know what? I feel like pissed the fucking day before. It's only one day in like, you know, in about 10 weeks I've ever done that. And I had a few drinks.
Why do you think you've done that?
Why did I do that? It's just, I don't know. That's what I'm saying. I knew it was time to quit because, you know, going back to the wall, you know, and legacy, I felt I'd done everything. Financially, I felt I was secure. I beat Hopkins, you know, but then you go up there. Maybe it's your ego as well, you know. It's just like, you know, you got the trappings, you got the money now, you know, sports personality of the year award, this, you know. And you're thinking, yeah, I don't know. It's got to test us all, isn't it? So I come back and Dad said, all you work for, you're going to fucking get beat. I went, what are you talking about? He just had a knack of knowing what to say and when to say it. Because we were so close. He's like my best friend.
Brother.
Not just my trainer, best friend, like since I was a kid. He just knew me so much and knew how to make me tick. And trust me, we went and trained on the pads. Like smashed the pads because of what he said. And bless him, man. Bless him.
How was that? Madison Square Garden, your last fight, Roy Jones. What's going through your mind? Did you feel mentally sharp going into that fight?
Yeah, I felt confident. I felt sharp. If you watch the fight, I'm dropping my hands. I still, even today, I don't know. It wasn't the plan. It just something that happened. And I think you can see in that fight, I knew it was my last fight. I was just enjoying myself. Except for the first round, I went on the floor again. Whoa, I got up. shit. And it was like a forearm. We look back, I went down on street, got caught with a forearm. I got up, but I remember going there into the Madison Square Garden in the afternoon when they just put in the ring together. And I was just looking around thinking, fucking, this is it, man. This is my last fight. Since I was a kid, like I'm in Madison Square Garden. And then it's like tingly, you know what I mean? It's like the atmosphere and just really soaking in the energy. And during the fight, you know, I was, whether I could have stopped Roy Jones or not, I was happy. I was enjoying doing the 12 rounds. And I always remember like the last few rounds. I still remember thinking, Joe, just look around. Last three rounds of your life. Last two rounds. And the last round, I was like, this is the last round of your life, man. Just enjoy it. That was what was in my head. And that was it. And after that fight, I knew that would be it. That would make a comeback. It wouldn't come back. People were saying, well, why don't you just get the 50-0? You're like three off, making history. But it just, that was my number 46. I was just, you know, I was, like I said, I just felt like it was time to think about my children, you know. Maybe think about myself, you know what I mean? Because like I said, I was getting injured all the time. You're getting punched, you're getting hit. You know, it's a long time to get hit and you got the rest of your life to live. And boxing is not everything, you know? So when I look back, part of me does think maybe I should have continued, and it really affected my father, my dad, not boxing again. I never really thought how my dad would be affected, because I like after boxing, you know, you are lost. I did feel pretty lost, man, because, you know, after the euphoria and the fucking, you're undefeated, man, you're top of the world, you know what I mean? You're Superman, you think you are. But, you know, there's other things except for boxing, and that's hard maybe to adapt and take in after a while, you know?
Do you think that's why a lot of boxers come back? Because there's a void missing?
Yeah, I think so. I think that is part of why they come back. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I missed the get up in the morning. Obviously, the euphoria win is nothing like it. You know, that regimental aspect of it where you got 12 weeks for the fight. So in between fights, I go on holidays, you know, get fat, eat loads of nice food you can afford it now, you know, have a good drink, then you're training again. So when that's gone, you know, you don't realize that what you're going to do, you know, you have to complete change of mindset because you haven't got that goal to fight again. So it's easy when people say, okay, well, do something else. Come on, you do anything you want to do, Joe. Okay, so I decided I went to London. I bought a nice place in London. It's sort of probably the worst thing I did. I was trying to be fucking an actor. No good. I done two little parts. But yeah, I was doing all these other things. And yeah, it was quite tough, you know. Done a few TV bits, TV things. And nothing really made me happy. You just accepting that you did do what you achieved, man, with your dad. Like you fucking done it, man. Do you know what I mean? So yeah, it took a while, you know, to be honest with you, it took a while to sort of come to terms with, you know, end the boxing.
Normality. But what a career, Joe, like to have 46 and 0, and it's easy for me to say looking from the outside, but to have 46 and 0, the world at your feet, known as one of the greatest of all times, going through that journey with your dad. We'll touch on your dad in a little bit, but we had we were speaking earlier that your dad was there when you were at your best. Your dad lived your journey with you. Like, my dad always seen me as a fuck up. He passed away when I was going through my life of drugs and crime and all the bullshit. Yeah. Now I'm starting to spread my wings, and part of me, like, my dad would have loved to have been here today. He was a massive fan of you. Like, he would have loved to have been at the interviews and meeting people. Like, he never seen me at my greatest. Your dad was there every minute living your dream with you. Like, that's a beautiful thing that will live for you until you take your last breath. Like, your legacy lives on forever. Every young boxer, every boxer that now looks up to Joe Kozaki as an inspiration. Like, 46, you know, will another British boxer ever do that? Like, you don't know with boxers just now. Like, people, it's mad. Like, some boxers don't even get past 30 fights now. There's like,
yeah, thanks, man. All these,
like, what you've done and what you've accomplished is fucking second to none. And that's the hard part. Like, any boxer would take for even half your fucking career. But to be 46 and all, king of the world, and then you still finishing boxing and feeling as if there's something missing, loneliness kicks in. It's scary like, how life can make the twists and turns like that. What do you think that is then, like, for you? Do you think that's gratitude, appreciation for what you've achieved, or the lack of things for boxers? Because you're used, you're a circus act as well for people, like the promoters, managers, do this. And then when you stop, there's fuck all else for you. It's like people go into the army, they come out and they've not got anything. The majority of people homeless are from ex-army, and it's mad. But do you think there should be more places putting things to help boxers for after their careers?
I think so. I think, you know, definitely it's a lot of depression that goes on. A lot of people lose their way. You know, it's sad, really, the toughest of sports. You know, I don't think it's enough protection for boxers or to go forward as regards to educating fighters, you know, giving them another, because 99% of boxers realistically don't make enough money to continue with their life and be comfortable. They have to get a job. And if they lost, what do they do? You know? So, yeah, it's tough, you know. A lot of sports is like that way. I mean, I sort of, you know, finished as the best you could finish undefeated, but still, I was lost. You know what I mean? I was lost. I was fucking lost, man, for a while. And, you know, I didn't realize it for a long time, you know. It took a long time. And, you know, everybody wants to invite you to a party. There's always something going on. There's holidays, this. You fucking indulge in lots of stuff. And, you know, and before you realize it, it got like fucking 10 years ago and passed. Wow, man, time goes quick. I think I should have stayed in the ring, as I say. Yeah, it was the best place to be, man. But, like you said, you know, to finish 40 undefeated is a blessing. But, you know, I still miss it. I kept away from boxing. Do you know what I mean? I consciously left boxing because of just politics. I don't know my life. But I think maybe I stayed away from it too long. You know, it's my boys, obviously, they got this gym back up and running. It was not useful for many years. And it's great that they love boxing. And obviously, they're good boxing trainers because they watch me and I've taught them for years, you know. And it's a continued legacy of my dad, you know. He'd love it. You know, I still feel his energy in his place. You know, he's missed every day, you know.
How was that for you, Joe, like the loss of your father? I know he's like brothers, best friends, like to live the career that you've done and him being by your side to then passing away. Did that really affect you mentally, Joe?
Oh, it's fucking what I say. It's a shock, you know. My dad was unbelievably fit. He had a few illnesses. And it was a shock, man. It's one of the things, it's still hard to believe. You know, I lost my dad in September 2018 and just fucking missed every day, you know. It's hard. And like, I lost my mum like 16 months later. You know, you think boxing's tough, but fucking real life is really tough. You know, God tests us all, as my dad used to say. And here is a test, my friend. You know, it's tough. But, you know, I'm a faith. You know, I still feel his energy. I know he's still with me, you know. And like you said, he's, you know, never forgotten the legacy he's done. What we've achieved in boxing means more for the fact he'll always be remembered, you know.
Yeah, he's had memories of live on. And I'm sorry to hear for your losses, but your Joe Calzaghe, that you'll bounce back from it. You'll use it as strength and fire for what you want to do for the next chapter of your life. It's easier said than done, loss, but we don't know how to handle loss or grief because we're all soft, Joe. We've been speaking, like, we're all sensitive beings. We're all searching for something to try and fulfill the pain and stop, like, the fucking meth, the madness that's up here. It's like the frog, big box of frogs, just everything jumping about, not knowing where to go. But like I says earlier, like what you've achieved, what you've accomplished, your mum and dad lived that life with you, getting to travel the world, seeing their son being one of the greatest. Like, that's a feeling that you can never buy. That like, people die without ever succeeding in anything in life. People lose parents and there's no connection with people's parents. Don't see their kids. Those kids don't even see their parents. Like, you've got a bond there that people would be proud of. There's probably people made amends with their fathers because they've probably seen the way yous acted on screen.
Nah, thanks,
love, man. Attention. The, like, no doubt there'll be fucking wars when the cameras are off, but
yeah,
he's, whatever mix yous had to create what you created, it worked perfectly. And I don't think that can be rectified. I don't think people can copy that. I think fathers and sons have tried with the boxing world, but never got as far as you two done. That's the most successful father and son boxing career I know anyway. Floyd Mayweather and his father, but I'm sure they fell out a few times, but your dad was there through thick and thin. And that's a beautiful thing. Like I say, they'll be proud, and I believe in energies and frequencies. I believe they'll still be here. And that's all you can do. So when you, after the career, do you regret not going to America quicker, Joe?
Do I regret? Everything's meant to be, man. I think it's all destiny. You know, I think it was just meant to be. It was meant to be a struggle. If it wasn't a struggle, I wouldn't be world champion. If I went to the Olympics and won that medal, I wouldn't be world champ 10 years. Probably have had the money when I was a kid and just fucking golf flash and just... It happens. It happens. You know, I had to struggle to be where I was. Even though I beat Chris Eubank for the title, I still couldn't afford my mortgage. Well, just about paid off my house at the time. So I wasn't getting big paydays till the end. So if I got big paydays, then that's the way I look at it. Do you know what I mean? So no, it was just perfect timing. I remember a story. I remember speaking to Emmanuel Stewart, the great Manny Stewart. He's working for HBO. And I remember speaking to him before the Roy Jones fight. So we just after the weigh-in, we talked. He said, Joe, what are you going to do after this fight? I said, and he's the only person I spoke to really, except for my family and my dad, that was going to be my last fight. So you're going to fight next? I said, Manny, I think this is going to be my last fight. And he was like, really? I went, yeah, I'm just thinking it's my last fight. He said, but I'm thinking about getting the 49-0. And I always remember what he said. He said, Joe, if you retire, he said, we have Rocky Marcel at 49 fights, but he had eight, I think about 8 world title fights. How many world title fights you had? They said 21 world title fights. So he'd be world champion, a white European fighter, be a world champion for 10 years. And this is his words, you come to America and not beat one black legend, but the second black legend in Roy Jones Jr. He said, if you retire, he said, people won't appreciate what you've done now. But he said, in the years to come, people will really appreciate because they won't happen again. And that was Manny Stewart saying that. Whether it happens again, maybe it will, maybe it won't. But the fact that he spoke to me just affirmed that it is the right thing to quit, you know, to retire because, you know, it was like 37, like 36, 37. And yeah, you got to be realistic that, you know, nobody's fucking Superman. Everybody is beatable on a given night. I've been beatable on a given night. Just when I fought, not my best fights, I was still better than my opponents. if I had fought not 100% against Kessler, against Lyson Hopkins, then could have lost. It's the way it is. Decision-wise, whatever, you know? So you just, you know, to me, that was just like, legacy meant more. Although sometimes I do think that, but I think, fuck, I should have kept going. See the money all these fighters are making. I wish my career was now with the social media shit that happens. You see all these fucking, like, these so-called YouTubers. I'm thinking, maybe I should still make a fight back.
Yeah. Maybe you should call one
maybe I should. But I think, you see, Roy Jones fought with Tyson, that exhibition, I think made more money there. Roy Jones, he did against me, and I was just 8-2 with around. So I'll fight you, Mike. Just give me 6 months training.
Would you ever, with the mindset you've got now, you seem to be getting your spark back, and do you know what, planning for the future, and big things are going to happen again, but do you ever feel as if, okay, do you know what, I fancy a little exhibition?
Yeah, I think so.
Yes, you're good.
Do you know what, why not? You see all these fighters making money, I'm thinking, you know, I ain't got the engine for 12 rounds anymore. Yes, I am a bit overweight. Never going to make sumo. I'll try to get a cruiserweight, but I still got hands to be, man. It's a little quick. It's a little sharp. It's a little reflexes. I've done a couple of rounds on the pads. I'm like, boy, dad, your hands are so quick. I went, yeah, it's a little quick. But do you know what? 8-2s?
Can't.
Why not?
Who would you call out?
Who's going to make me the most money?
what about Steve Collins?
No, Steve. Well, I don't know. I'd fight anybody. It'd be a bit of fun. Now, do you know what? I was thinking about doing it for my 50th next year.
Go for
so
that.
So maybe I'm doing it for my 50th. We'll see. I'll get back in a bit of training and see how the old bones carry on. But you know what? It's just
Yeah, it's a great sport, man. Love the sport. And it's great to see fighters come back and have a bit of fun in the ring.
Tyson and Jones fight was good. It was fucking actually okay, man. Tyson was decent. I thought it was like, remember, he's in his 50s.
I know.
He's fucking, do you know what I mean? Like, do you think that's what you need? A bit of structure? How would you feel, though, with your old boy not being there?
Yeah, that's the one thing, you know. I have thought about that because when I lost my dad, I thought I could never box again anyway, you know, because dad was, obviously, we were just in, he was always in the corner. But if I was doing an exhibition, I'm sure my son's in the corner. Mm-hmm. So it'll still be, you know, his blood still runs through our veins. So it'd be like, he would be there anyway, you know?
Yeah, you asked for boxing, like you are do you think you came away from it though for the 10 years or whatever, how many years were away, because you could have got sucked back into it and you could have possibly took another fight on?
Yeah, possibly, that's maybe what it was. Yeah, that's maybe what it was. I still think back to why did I just leave Wales and go to London, and probably at the time, in hindsight, I'll think back, because my dad's not here, maybe I lost a lot of time. Dad wanted to continue boxing, managing and training, and me not being in the gym probably affected dad, because I didn't really think at the time that, you know, he'd miss box as much as he did. And I was just getting on with my life, you know, I was just trying to do other things, TV, do all that bullshit, you know, you think it's the right thing to do at the time. But I think it was to escape, you know, doing one thing all your life, you know. I think it was just escaping, trying to do other stuff and trying to get out of my system, but it doesn't just go out your system. Yeah. You know what I mean? That's who I am. And obviously I am Joe, you know, the person, you know what I mean? But boxing is, you know, the sport of boxing gave me the life I have, you know, and made a legacy for myself, for my father, you know, for my kids, for the gym. And obviously very proud of that. And yeah, you know, maybe it's time now, you know, now I'm feeling pretty good, you know, coming to 50 is a big milestone. It's time to reflect and look at life and what you've done, what you've achieved, things you've done wrong. And like I said, my sons, they love boxing, and maybe it's time to give them a helping hand, and hopefully, who knows, maybe make a world champion from you one day, you know.
That's in your blood. I think that's where you'll thrive. I think that's when you're feeling most alive and you feel as if important, that no matter what car we drive or how much money we're making, there's something missing if we're not trying to achieve an end product, an end goal, to working towards something. Like, no matter what you put your mind to, you want to become the best.
Yeah.
And that's where you think, fuck it. But now you're getting that spark back. You're hitting to that 50 and you're thinking, there's people training, what age is Freddie Roach? What, they're in their 60s and they're still training.
Yeah.
World fighters, like world class fighters. Like, you've got the ability. So that's you. You can't just, I'm not saying quit, but give up. Like, we all have our wobbles, but you've got the potential to be teaching someone who just stays around the corner to be one of the greatest as well. You've got the ability, you've got the backup to do it. You've got the knowledge to help train somebody to leave and change their family's life the way that your dad helped you do with your career. Do you know what I mean? I think that's where you'll feel more alive, standing in somebody's corner. For my personal opinion, standing in somebody's corner and training an absolute legend to then you taking it all in, and that's you kind of replacing for what your dad did for you. And I think that's where you'll feel the spark and go, do you know what, fuck it, to have that something.
Yeah,
it's in your blood. You always want to fight. You can fucking maybe call somebody out when you're 60, 70, you don't know. the way the world's going. How have you battled what the last 2-3 years with, like, drink, partying and stuff like that? Because now you're, is it 8 months not touched a beer?
Sobriety, man. So 8 months, I think, you know, I think, obviously, it was tough. Lost my dad, like I said, in always like the drink and that, you know. But I suppose after I lost my dad, it was just such a shock, you know. And you just fucking grief, so awful thing. And somebody I was so close to, you know, it's you just try to black it out, you know. You just, you know, have denial, all the aspects of loss. And then I was just fucked at the time, mate. You know what I mean, I'll be honest with you, I was just a massive struggle, and it's just the most horriblest fucking thing to ever go through. As you know yourself, mate, it's an awful thing. It's hard to explain to somebody who's never been through that. And just denial, just fucking drinking, you know, I suppose it got a bit out of hand, just trying to fucking blacken out, really. And I was lost, man, because he was my fucking hero. And like I said, my mum, she got ill, and
like I said, I lost my mum as well. And that was awful. And I felt that I had a realization that, you know, I got two sons, you know what I mean? I got myself, we do create legacy. I got my faith, I believe in God. So I believe, isn't even though it was a tragedy that happened, you know, my boys needed me, you know? And I probably wasn't there for them as I should have been. Because I was a bit fucking lost, mate. Like we all struggled. But turn of the year, I decided, pretty a spiritual awakening, mate.
Yes.
I decided that was it. And I don't want to hurt myself to do this anymore. I just want to be the best person I can be and live life. Life is beautiful, man, you know? And like I said, you know, just stopped, you know? Just stopped, just dropped drinking completely. And, you know, just living a clean life, trying to... The eating habits are not that good, mate. I'm still eating too much, right? So I'm actually going to try the vegan. I've been trying to do the vegan diet. But yeah, I just want to, you know, focus on next chapter of my life. You know, like I said, I believe in my heart and my mum and dad are still here. And, you know, I'm very blessed to have, to still be here myself. I'm still blessed to have two amazing sons, you know, I'm extremely proud of, you know, and who want to continue the box. They love it. It's in them, you know, they do it because they want to do it. Come on, man, this is like you just saying just now, this is going to be the next chapter. I mean, maybe we'll make another world champion and this will we kick on and keep it going because we work too hard to just let it fucking go away, man. You know, I mean, I work too hard in my life to let it go.
What was that realization for you, Joe, when you're going through your dark time drinking? Was it every day you were drinking?
Well, I wouldn't say every day, but I was just fucking, you know, drinking. I'm just drinking quite a bit, fucking smoking a bit of weed. And it was ridiculous. Fucking hell. A bit too old for that shit. Never used to do any of that. And then, but you know, it was just escapism, man. You know what I mean? It was lost, man. It's like you're just trying to deal with grief, with the pain. And even now, I still struggle to struggle with it. But I suppose with sobriety, you get clarity. And it hurts, but you're clear. You're present.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a lot of time to reflect, think back on things. Obviously, sometimes you have regrets, but hey, you know, the past is the past. You know, to learn to live in the present and be happy. Life is beautiful. Not think too much of the future because, fuck, you don't know what's
that's painful as well.
Yeah, you don't know what's in the future. Like you told me in 2018, all this shit was going to happen in life. You know, so many things happened, like, more than I've said. So many things happened. It's like anything can be taken away from you at any time. So, you know, I'm just happy. I just take one day at a time, be happy, you know, just my boys, like I said, get this gym rock and rolling. Who knows, man? Who knows what's around the corner, you know?
Yeah, and that's the beautiful thing about life. We never know what's around the corner. Let's try to enjoy the moments. We spoke about the book, The Power of Now, when we're on the phone, Joe, and you're just about to read it. I think that's for anybody watching or struggling. Like, the pain's always still going to be there. The loss of your mum, your dad, their birthdays, their Christmases, New Year's Eve. Like, the pain's always going to be there. But you try to get rid of that pain by tanning a bottle or taking a line of gear or smoking weed, whatever the fuck it is that people do. The pain's going to be there and it's going to be 100 times worse doing that shit. When you become clear, when you become sober, when you become clean, whatever, you see the world differently. You understand, oh, wait a minute. Stop feeling sorry for yourself. Stop self-loathing. I'm fucking Joe Calzaghe. I'm James English. We can do something with our life. We can make changes, but nobody's coming to save you, Joe. Nobody's going to chap your window and say, Joe, let's get your fucking finger out. The only person that can save yourself is yourself. That's like. Great. But when you start getting a clearer conscience, like you've got the spark back, like where you now know that you want to do something. Like life's not over, for fuck's sake. You're Joe Calzaghe, you're 46 and all. You're fucking undisputed champion of the world. Do you know what I mean? You're two-weight world champion.
Yeah.
But that just goes for anybody watching that. Even Joe Calzaghe struggles. No matter who you are, no matter what you achieve in life, we all battle. We all breathe the same air. We're all winging it to try and find something, to find a sense of completion. But then when we do it, like you winning your belts, not always use Tyson Fury's prime example as well, like won all the belts, had all the money, had all the attention, but yet had the biggest depression of his life, but yet people maybe think he should be happier, but it's not because there's no manual or blueprint how we should live this life, how we should be getting through it. We kind of just grasp onto something like you doing the boxing. It's the fact that you love boxing, but it's also the fact that you are working all the time. Yeah. So it doesn't make us sit with our own thoughts. And when you start making those adjustments and changes, you feel amazing. You start feeling a freshness about you and a spark. Like 8 months, I take my hat off to you, brother. It's amazing.
Yeah, thanks, man.
This is only the beginning of your new chapter.
Yeah.
As simple as that. Like, see, when you got the realization, right, enough's enough, what hit you?
I just went away. I just went on holidays and said, just had the guts for me. Just went on holidays, arguing with my girlfriend and had fucking just being an ass. And he was just like, that was it, man. Just, I had just a spiritual awakening, man. It's like, I had a really good think and I had this little sit down and think that I can't go on like this. You know, I want to be a role model to my boys. Like, you can tell you're a father, you can tell your boys anything, but you got to lead by example, right?
Yeah.
Like, and that's the way it is. You got to lead by example. And I knew that going forward, I wanted to get fit again, healthy, fit, and basically come to terms with my losses, my father, come to terms with the losses of my mum. And so I'm trying to move forward with my life and be happy, like, at the end of the day, you know what I mean? It's like people worry about fucking money too much, you know, there's fame, and that didn't bother me. At the end of the day, it's you realize that you come in with the world with nothing, you leave with nothing. It was just, that's it. So you can't take anything with you, man, but what you can do is make a blueprint, make a legacy, and touch as many people as you can, and that's what I want to do. And whether it's been the boxing or I don't know, like you said, I'm 50 next year, so I'm looking forward to the future. I don't know what the future holds, but I'm looking forward to it. I just want to be, you know, positive, and just move forward and try and be happy.
Yeah, you just got to be a role model, not just for yourself, but for your kids, people who's watching you. Like, your legacy's there forever. That can never be touched. Like, for your kids to then see you winning world titles, going to Americans, smoking the Americans, to then seeing you maybe struggling. Like, it doesn't just, the person who's an addict or the person who's battling, everything has that effect of the people around them as well. You don't just destroy yourself, you destroy everybody else that fucking try to make you feel better. Because when I was going through my journey, when I was line after line and partying and shagging everything, Joe, like, everybody was to fucking blame. Everybody was to blame.
It's always somebody else's fault except yourself.
Why are you bringing those drugs to this party? But nobody forces me to take lines. Nobody was forcing me to gamble or place joints, smoke joints, but I done it because I was unhappy. I done it because I was miserable. I done it because I was depressed. So everybody that's battling or over drinking or overeating or taking drugs, you're depressed. No matter what way you look at it, you're scared of reality. You can't handle reality. You can't handle the pain. So what I see is weakness. Why? Because I was weak.
Yeah.
And then when you start making those adjustments and changes, you start going, fuck me. The scary thing about change, Joe, is when I started changing, my conscience grew. Every girl I fucked over, every relationship, not really seeing the kids the way I should be, and your conscience grows, then you become, because we're all sensitive beings, we know what we're doing wrong, but sometimes you can't help contain yourself with doing bad shit, and that's the scary part. When you start doing the changes, then now we're at a stage where we are clean and healthy, and we are seeing the world differently, and now we can make the changes from now to then generate for a better future for those people around us who deserve a better life. And I met one of your sons today, man, he's fucking great shape. Like, I've spoke to Joe a couple of times as well on Twitter. Another great kid, like, you've raised great sons,
great,
like,
great boys.
What else can you wish? What else do you need in life? So you're already winning, Joe. You've already, your legacy lives forever. That's never going to be touched. Your sons are fit and fucking healthy. Boom. Life's complete. Like, everything else that you do in your life is a bonus, not the dark stuff. Because that just makes you a miserable bastard and just hating life. Like, what's the plans now for Joe Kazagi for the future? You're now making adjustments to then go, do you know what? Life's not over. Yes, I've got some loss and pain, but you know what? That just makes you a stronger character. It does. Once you start dealing with it, like, you don't learn. The pain's always going to be there, Joe.
Yeah,
but what happens is you learn how to deal with it. You learn how to deal with the bullies. You learn how to become one of the best fighters ever. You learn, everything's about a learning curve. Every day is a school day. You learn, you grow, and you go, do you know what? It's pain, but you just kick on and move from it. So what's the plans now for the future, brother?
Plans now, bro, is just take a day at a time. You know, like I said, you know, it's this gym. I'm not going to get back in the boxing, whether it's going to be managing, training, making another world champion, helping kids coming through, helping kids to find, because boxing is tremendous, you know, to take people off the street. I'm waiting, man. Just things are going to happen. Like I said, this gym now, the boys love it. Like I said, you know, potentially get back into boxing. What is kick some ass in an exhibition or get my ass kicked in an exhibition? Who cares?
Yeah.
And or manage, you know, that's I had my manager's license a few years ago, but dad got ill, so I didn't do it. I have, in the past, I'd, you know, top fighters asked me to train them. But I think the thing is that boxing is my love. And no matter what else I try, you know what I mean? Might even do this and that. Boxing's always what's made me happy. It's made me who I am. It's given me a fantastic life. And I love to, you know, in the future, give my experiences and my knowledge onto other fighters.
Yeah.
Because it's still there. Maybe my left hand is not as good, but I still got enough humor.
It's always going to be there, Joe, and that's is what I'm saying. That sometimes taking that break, having your all-time highs in life, to then having your all-time lows, to then understanding, you start appreciating life more and going, you know what? Fuck it, man. Let's go. I believe you will train world-class fighters. I believe you will have titles in here from other fighters, but that's just down to you. Once you get that spark back, you realise, fuck me, you might even want to fucking fight again. Like Roy Jones is fucking fighting. Like, he won a world title 3-4 years ago, did he not? Like, he won a title just a few years, I think 2016.
Hopkins, 16.
That's unbelievable.
There's
always a fight in the dog, man. Like, was there any fights, Joe, you'd have loved to have had any name over the years?
I don't know what it's. People ask me that question. I do. This is like, it's hard to say. Obviously, Steve Collins was champion. It would be nice to box Steve Collins. It'd be nice to fight the guys I fought when they were champions or just lost their titles. But you know what? It just is what I can't really complain. Nah. You know? I feel like, what can I say? You know, I can't complain. I'm glad I signed with Mickey Dev. Taylor was for £300 a week. I don't turn back things. I have made mistakes. We all make mistakes. We're human, you know. But at the end of the day, thank God, you know, I feel blessed to be not only being able to be a world champion for as long, but to be able to share their moments with my father in the corner. You know, I'm more than blessed. And it's, you know, maybe it's took a while to realize that. And I suppose, my children are blessed. You know, I just want to be able to share the experiences I've had in the future, you know. But I suppose at the moment, it's all about getting healthy, getting fit again, losing a bit of weight, and you know, living life.
And that'll come, Joe. That's why I think exercise is key. Like, you're at the top of your game because you were exercising every day. Once you stop exercising, now just because your boxing career's over, it doesn't mean you stop exercising, because then that's when the demons kick in. That's when all the negative thoughts kick in, because you're not getting the serotonin, the endorphins, the dopamine, all the feel-good factors. That cold shower before the racy fight, though, I mean, it changed your whole mindset. Yeah. We need to get you in the cold water, Joe.
I was only in there for 3 seconds. I'm such a baby. I can go water.
3 seconds takes a long way.
I only jumped in the plunge pool once in my life. I was like, I can't walk. I jumped straight back out, honestly.
Well, one last question, my brother. For anybody watching that's maybe going through a struggle just now in life, what advice would you give for them?
Just to, if you can't get help, just read, just try to, it's a difficult one. Try not to dwell on the past, you know. Try not to have resentment. Try not to slide, is the word, right?
Drift.
Try not to drift. It's so easy to drift. Just, there's always somebody out there to help. And me personally is just living in the moment. I think we spend too much time thinking too much of the future and too much of the past. And at the end of the day, what really matters right now, and exercise and eat well. Don't drink.
Don't drugs. Smoke weed. But Joe, for coming on today and telling your story, I thoroughly enjoyed
that. Thank you,
you're an absolute legend for being so open and honest about your own battles and demons. This will help a lot of people as well. But in the boxing world, your legacy will live forever. Your mum and dad will still be here just they'll put your shoulder, you'll feel their presence. I know people might think that shit's weird, but you know yourself, you know that you're always here, you're always supported, you're always will be protected. But going forward for the future, I can't wait to see what you bring, man, because I've got a good feeling big things are going to happen. But
thank you, brother.
Just keep fighting a good fight, brother, and stay strong.
Thank you.
God bless you. You can also watch my podcast on my YouTube channel. The link is in the bio if you'd like to subscribe. You can follow me on my social media platforms to see who my next guest is. Follow me on Facebook at JamesEnglish11, Twitter, JamesEnglish0, Instagram, JamesEnglish2. You can also download these podcasts on iTunes or Spotify.